You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. As the use of cold hard cash has declined in the U.S. over the years, some businesses have gone cashless, only accepting credit cards or other forms of digital payment. A new bill in the Wisconsin legislature wants to change that and require businesses to accept cash as a form of payment on most transactions under $2,000. Republican Representative Michael Schrah of Oshkosh is the lead author of the bill and presented it this week to an assembly committee.
The statement, "This note is legal tender for all debts, public and private," is found on every single piece of paper currency in circulation, and yet there is no federal requirement to accept that currency during a transaction. Over the last couple of years, numerous businesses have made the change to not accept cash payments. While it is convenient to just use your card and be done with the transaction in seconds, this mandate can be overly burdensome to pay for necessities. It leaves out individuals who are unwilling or unable to use cashless payments.
Similar laws have passed in other states and in some cases cities around the country. Today we're finding out more about that bill and how cash and cashless transactions affect different businesses and consumers. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you want businesses in Wisconsin to be required to accept cash? Why or why not? And what is your preference? Do you try to use cash whenever possible? Do you try to use something other than cash whenever possible? If you're a business owner yourself, we'd love to hear from you about the best way to get paid. Join in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Anya Van Wagtendonk is a Capitol reporter for WPR. I talked to her earlier today. Anya, give us the outlines. What would this bill do if ultimately passed?
Basically, no retail establishment could refuse to accept cash for purchases under $2,000. So you've probably been to like a new coffee shop that only takes cards or Apple Pay or whatever. So those types of cashless establishments would be more or less outlawed, and businesses would be subject to fines up to $5,000 if they refuse to take cash.
What is the argument behind the bill from the sponsors of the legislation?
Yeah, there are a few different arguments for these types of proposals, but Representative Schrah's main explanation was that it takes away consumer choice. So he thinks that customers should get to decide how they pay for goods and services. He also thinks that moving away from cash is sort of like a gimme to credit card companies. And so there's also a bit of an argument for being aware of personal finances, that kind of forcing that move to rely on things like credit cards could encourage more irresponsible spending behavior. There's also an argument that these types of requirements, or going cashless rather, disenfranchises particular groups who don't have access to banks or credit cards. So that could be people who don't use those institutions for religious or ideological reasons, but also lower income people are just less likely to have access to banks. Some people can't afford to maintain a bank account. And so some people say that, you know, cashless really kind of disenfranchises those people from being able to access those types of businesses.
There was an assembly committee hearing. Did we hear any kind of pushback there? If so, what were the counter arguments?
Yeah, it's interesting. So there's, you know, kind of a pro-business argument on both sides of this issue. There are several small business owners on that committee. And so some of them were focused on sort of the rights of business owners to make choices about how to conduct their own businesses. And so, you know, some small businesses especially say that going to only card or only mobile payments, it can cut down on labor costs or time spent at the counter, sort of just generally streamline the retail process. And so some businesses prefer that. And so some lawmakers say business owners should have the right to decide how to set up their own businesses.
The lead sponsor is a Republican. Are we seeing any kind of bipartisan support for this anti-cashless bill?
Yeah, two Milwaukee Democrats are signed on. I haven't spoken to them directly, but I think that shows sort of the interesting unification that can happen on issues like this. Milwaukee, up until recently, actually had a fairly high rate of unbanked people. And so I could see that being an issue that could, you know, disproportionately affect some lower income residents of Milwaukee, sort of compared to the rest of the state. And also, when you look at other places that have passed these kinds of bills. Notably, that's New York, Washington, D.C., and Philly. So those are big Democratic strongholds. And so I think that gives an interesting sense, even though this is a GOP proposal, that it could, you know, get support from both parties.
A similar bill has been proposed in the past in Wisconsin, didn't end up going anywhere. It's always tough to tell at the outset whether something's going to fly through the legislature or just kind of go to a committee and then slowly disappear. Did you get any sense of momentum or timeline setting for this particular legislation?
No, you know, I don't have a sense of sort of timing or its odds. But I think, again, as we've discussed, there is this way in which disparate groups are kind of united on this issue and then also divided on the issue. So, for example, you know, groups who might support this type of bill might be advocates for lower income people who can't use banks. But then it also might be people, you know, more off the grid groups who don't use banks. Right. And so those particular groups might not always be on the same side of political issues, but they could be on this one. And then, as I mentioned, there's that kind of pro-business argument on either side, whether it's a consumer choice or a business operator choice argument, that could divide, I think, Republicans in particular. So unclear yet which of those arguments sort of wins the day and whether any one of them propels this bill to the floor. But I guess we will see in the new year.
Anya, thanks a lot for joining us again.
Thanks for having me.
That's WPR Capitol reporter Anya Van Wagtendonk bringing us the latest on a bill in the state legislature that would require businesses to accept cash payments. Now we're taking a step back to talk more broadly about how we use cash and the role it plays in our economy and society. You could join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts on the idea of a state law requiring businesses to accept cash, and let us know your habits, if you like to use cash or you don't. 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Ursula Dollinghouse joins us now, assistant professor of anthropology at Ripon College. She researches economic anthropology and the anthropology of money. Ursula, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Before we get into the topic, how did you go from anthropology into studying specifically the anthropology of money?
Oh, great question. Well, to make a long story short, my dissertation research was looking at the introduction of the euro currency back when it was a new shared currency among many member states. And so I was very interested in what that experience might be to share a common currency across different nation states. So that led me to doing research with the German Central Bank and looking specifically at the role of cash as a medium of connecting people to central banks, but also to these kinds of really unprecedented projects. So that's kind of how I got started. But there's a long history of research on money and value in anthropology, often in non-Western societies, but also more recently in, you know, really all over the globe. So there's a lot of insights that one can gain cross-culturally on the use of money and cash particularly.
Hey, now there's talk sometimes that we're going to end up, you know, people are using cash less, we're going to end up as a cashless society. You've written in the past that, you don't see this being very likely. You see cash very likely to stick around. Why is that?
So I think there are two main reasons I would mention now. One is the experiential use of cash, its materiality, its qualities and affordances, to use a design term in terms of, you know, what having a physical token, if you will, that can be used, it's issued by a central authority, but yet it can be used outside of the purview of that central authority. And that's very unique to cash as legal tender. Obviously, I'm recognizing the caveats underlying that in terms of trusting monetary authorities, you know, having a stable economy. But that sort of brings me into the second reason, and that is that cash is actually the only form of public money. People may not realize that, you know, all electronic or digital money is essentially private money. And only cash is public money issued by the state or, you know, issued by central banks. And so there's a public dimension to that medium that's quite important. And so currently, central banks globally are committed to maintaining cash as a complementary form of payment to digital. There are more recently explorations into introducing a digital version of fiat. So that's a very interesting topic users can be aware of, or listeners can be aware of. In Europe, they're actually going forward with a project to experiment with this. In the US, the Fed has basically sort of said it doesn't see a reason to introduce it anytime soon. That can always change. But in short, cash is really central to connecting us to not only the state and central authorities, but its independence of that and how it's used also for non-monetary purposes means that it connects us deeply to others through social relationships, ritual practices, many other use cases for physical cash. So I think those are some of the key reasons I think it's around to stay, at least for some time.
We're talking to Ripon College anthropology professor Ursula Dollinghouse about cash and cashless transactions as a new bill in the state legislature aims to require businesses to accept cash payments. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you started using cash less often over time? Are you someone who doesn't carry cash at all, pays everything with credit card or one of the many new digital payment apps? Or does cash rule everything around you? Do you think businesses should be required to accept cash? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up next on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Ursula Dollinghouse, assistant professor of anthropology at Ripon College, who researches economic anthropology and the anthropology of money. She's with us today to talk about how businesses and consumers use cash, as lawmakers are proposing a bill that would require businesses in Wisconsin to accept cash for transactions, as some businesses don't right now. You could join in at 800-642-1234. As a consumer, do you prefer being able to pay in cash, or do you have money on you as little as possible? If you're on the business side of things, what are you seeing? And have you encountered cashless businesses much lately? Just a block apart were a couple bars. One only took money. One didn't take money at all. Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Bruce is with us in Waterford. Bruce, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to bring up?
Well, your question that you keep asking is, should businesses be required to accept cash? And I don't feel like businesses should be required to accept cash. I like cash and enjoy using it, but I can always take my business elsewhere. In most cases, I think it would be foolish for a business not to accept cash. Some examples might be, you know, some kind of business, a hot dog stand or something that might be prone to being robbed. They might want to not have cash on hand, so that's not an issue. But, you know, for most of your, like, stores, I don't think that not taking cash would be a smart move. I mean, I don't know that I know anything about the subject, really, but that's just my first take on it.
Bruce, thanks a lot for sharing your take on that. And Ursula, he brings up a couple of interesting points. First of all, it sounds like Bruce is cool with using cash, doesn't necessarily like the idea of requiring businesses to take cash. What are your thoughts on this state legislation we were talking about? Should we mandate accepting cash?
Yeah, well, it's a really interesting question. I mean, I definitely empathize with the hot dog stand owner who might, you know, be constrained in terms of what payment options they could accept. So I think, you know, any legislation should, you know, make some accommodations for situations where it's simply impossible. It sounds like from the language on the bill, that there would be some exceptions there. It's not really fleshed out in the bill. But on the other hand, I think that having a general mandate could be important because what people may not realize is that in order to keep the cash system sustainable, it also has to be used. And so currently, you know, cash is heavily subsidized by the state, if you will. It also settles at face value without fees associated with it, at least for the consumer. But all forms of payment cost money. of course. And so I think having a mandate that allows people who really don't have an option other than cash to be able to access essential goods and be participants in collective life is really essential. But of course, there are always situations where someone may be more limited in terms of cash that they can accept. And of course, safety issues are certainly one of the reasons why businesses and organizations have moved away from cash. But I would also say that there are other types of risks associated with digital payments. So it might be worth sort of thinking about the pros and cons of all of the different options out there.
Bruce, thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Irene joins us now in Phillips. Irene, hi.
Hi there. I have just a comment to make. My hair salon here in Phillips requests cash only because they would pay a fee. They would have to pay a fee for people using credit cards. And I can understand that completely. So I go to the bank before I visit the hairstyling salon. Thank you.
Irene, thanks a lot for sharing that. And I deal with businesses sometimes, the stores, Ursula, that take cash only for that reason, or restaurants that'll have that upcharge if you pay with credit. So do you get a sense that there are a lot of businesses just for sheer economic reasons might make the same decision as her salon does?
Oh, absolutely. And in fact, I was just part of an international conference on the future of cash where this topic came up as well, that internationally, more businesses are offering, you know, an option to pay in cash that is, you know, a way to avoid the surcharge fees associated with credit card payments, but giving people really an incentive to use cash instead of digital in that case. And, you know, you see it around where I live too, in terms of there's a gas station that offers a 5% discount, I believe, if you pay in cash, because the surcharge fees and interchange fees associated with credit card payments are quite costly. There's been some debate about that recently as well. And so it sort of highlights the way in which cash actually is the only form of money not controlled by a private profit-driven entity. So we're kind of seeing the tension there around different channels of value and making payments and, you know, the costs associated with that. But I do believe that we're seeing more instances where businesses and entities are wanting to accept cash payments to kind of mitigate those fees.
Talking about cash and the possibility of cashless economies with Ursula Dollinghaus from Ripon College, anthropologist who studies money. And we'll go back to your calls at 800-642-1234. Bernadette is with us in Baraboo. Bernadette, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What's your story, Bernadette?
Yeah, I just, my husband and I own self-storage business and in Lake Dalton. And one of the things that we've run across through is the cash payments, and we do almost everything electronically. So we don't often meet with people at the facility. We do everything via email. And so what we've run into is there are people that need to pay with cash, and we understand that and try to be as accommodating as we can, but we don't want to meet everybody every time. Like, you have hundreds of renters. You don't want to have to arrange to meet with them. So one option we have found that we recommend is cashier's checks, where people can go to Walmart or Quick Trip for a very low fee and, you know, turn their cash into a cashier's check or money order and then pay with that, and that's a little safer. And then they could drop that in our Dropbox because we don't want to have cash in our Dropbox.
Fair enough. Bernadette, thanks a lot for the call. Again, Ursula, that non-cash option requires either access to a bank or you got to pay for it, whether it's the credit card fees or the fee to get that cashier's check. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is a case where people do need to pay a fee in order to translate that cash into digital form in this particular business context. I guess the larger question we could ask as a society is, you know, at what point does the ability to make payments for things that we need to do in our lives have this added on cost that becomes prohibitive? And I worry in particular about not only unbanked, but underbanked people who, you know, are then sort of forced to pay more to use cash than, you know, others who have multiple different options for payment. So, you know, again, in particular situations, it's very understandable that, as I said, there's a cost to all payments, including cash. The question is, who's bearing that cost? And to what extent is, you know, payments more broadly a public good that should have some oversight in terms of, you know, what's acceptable, what's feasible for people to manage their lives?
Thanks again for that call. We just have a few moments left. Ursula, you were just at a big international conference. What are you watching for next in the story of money and cashless money?
So what I'm very curious about is, as I mentioned earlier, the European Central Bank is rolling out an experiment with digital fiat. And what's interesting about that is that, again, there's a commitment to maintaining a complementarity between physical cash and a digital version of it. However, the digital version has some other aspects to it that people should think about, namely that one can't be completely anonymous with a digital form of fiat, and that there might be limitations on how much one could hold in a digital fiat. And, you know, it would also be intermediated by commercial banks and other financial institutions. So what you're kind of seeing is, you know, to what extent can a complementarity be maintained between physical cash and a digital form of state-issued money? You know, the details of this are far off on the horizon, but I think they will be interesting to follow in the European case to see, like, what are the pragmatics of that scenario look like, and, you know, what new kind of considerations will there be for all of us globally.
That's Ursula Dollinghaus from Ripon College talking about money. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Facebook is the biggest social media platform in the world. The company claims over 3 billion users, more than a third of the population of the planet. Mark Zuckerberg once said that he wanted Facebook's user base to grow 10% every year forever. Many of the features that led to the company's explosive growth also caused major problems on the website and in the real world. The site fostered hate speech, drove polarization and conspiracy theories, and even enabled drug and human trafficking. And another platform owned by the company, Instagram, had measurable mental and emotional health impacts, for the worse, especially for teen girls. And people inside the company were aware of these problems almost every step of the way. Our next guest worked very closely with the woman behind many of those revelations, Facebook whistleblower Frances Haugen. Here's Haugen at a Senate hearing in 2021.
The company's leadership knows how to make Facebook and Instagram safer, but won't make the necessary changes because they have put their astronomical profits before people. The company intentionally hides vital information from the public, from the U.S. government, and from governments around the world.
We're talking about the many problems that have come to light over the years with Facebook. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think Facebook has lived up to its promise of connecting people, or in your view, has it done more harm than good? Have your own Facebook or Instagram habits changed as the platforms came under more public scrutiny? Do you see problematic posts and misinformation in your own feeds? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Jeff Horwitz is a technology reporter at the Wall Street Journal and author of Broken Code: Inside Facebook and the Fight to Expose Its Harmful Secrets. He won several awards for his reporting on the Facebook Files, a Wall Street Journal investigation into the platform. Jeff, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Oh, certainly. Thanks for having me.
I want to start with some of your reporting that just hit the Wall Street Journal today, Jeff, very relevant to what you write about in the book. You write about, again, you talked about this in the summer as well, Meta, the parent company, ongoing problems keeping pedophiles off of Facebook and Instagram, and the recommendation platforms actually promoting groups with harmful child sexual content. What is going on?
So this work actually kind of came out of the book project. The issue here is that Meta is extremely good at personalizing content for users depending on their interests. It's that doesn't mean that they know everything about you or that they somehow know everything you like. It means that they can detect patterns of behavior among users. So let's say if you and me consume similar content and like similar things, they might suggest that we should get to know each other, or that we should, if you like a page, that I should follow it too. These are the sorts of connections that sort of the algorithm draws. And it turns out that that is great for getting people connected with their hobbies and with people they might want to know. It's also very good at building really insidious networks. And in this instance, we're talking about people who are interested in sexually exploiting children. The work we've done over the last 6 months, I think, demonstrates that even following young gymnast influencers, like gymnasts and models, basically just kids, is enough to trigger Instagram to start recommending sex content. Now, that might not seem like a natural thing to do. If you're interested in children and gymnastics, therefore, you're probably going to be interested in sex. It turns out that a large community of people who are interested in that stuff are following those children, and that as soon as sort of someone acts in a similar way by following them, the platform sort of starts probing to see what else they might like that kind of really toxic community is into. And so this is, this isn't something brand new. This is an understood problem inside the company. It just comes with running kind of black box recommendation systems. They're very efficient, but they're very hard to control. And it's the same sort of thing that, say, led to fomenting the Stop the Steal movement related to the 2020 election, which was a, very heavily Facebook amplified claims of election fraud in 2020 that preceded the January 6th riot. So this is kind of a, it's kind of to some degree more of the same, though I do think obviously that if you can't recommend content in a way that is safe related to children, that does seem like something that's problematic for a trillion-dollar company.
And this, with example after example, seems to be a running theme, a tension between what boosts user numbers, user engagement, the amount of time people spend and interact with Facebook for the most part, this applies to Instagram as well, versus integrity teams and others within the company raising concerns about the impact, the harm it could cause, and that drive to boost the numbers, mostly, almost always, winning out. Can you talk about that tension you saw emerge over your reporting?
Yeah, so this is a, I think, a fascinating thing, which is that you wouldn't necessarily think it's the case, but on a practical basis, the growth of the company ended up being, shall we say, negatively correlated with the quality of the content that was being distributed. In other words, the more vitriolic, the more aggressive, the more salacious, the more clickbaity, the more violent or pornographic the content, generally the better it did. Now, there was a limit to that, but if you're just posting the most obscene things in the world, eventually your account's going to get taken down. But the it turns out that, and people inside the company were warning about this for years, that if you just boost things based on whether or not they get a response, you don't get great content. As I think a number of employees memorably noted, it's great. It's a great way to promote cat videos. It's not so great when it comes to health information or political news or anything like that. The what was, I think, became very clear is that the platform was regularly getting gamed by bad actors. So maybe that was Russians, but generally it wasn't. Generally, it was just anyone who figured out that you could get to the top on Facebook by just professionally posting, the crazy, the crazier the better type content.
Let's talk about Facebook and polarization. We've seen official statements from Facebook over the years. You report on some of them, I think, saying, yeah, we're a reflection of polarization in the world. We're not causing it. But you trace stories in places like Poland and here in the United States, elsewhere around the world, where politicians are realizing we want our message to get picked up on Facebook, it has to be more negative. It has to generate more anger. What happened on Facebook seems to have driven the way people do politics. Can you talk about that a little?
Yeah, and this is astonishing, and it applies on both the left and the right. In some countries, it's more on the left. In some countries, it's more on the right. Depends on the country. But pretty early on I shouldn't say super early on. I don't think the company understood what they were doing at first. Mm-hmm. But by 2019, it was very apparent that the way that they had sort of turbocharged engagement on the platform, which was really rewarding content that received a lot of emojis, comments, and reshares, that really rewarded some of the angriest content you could find. And you know, what happened is that a lot of political parties that were sort of professionals at trying to get attention, right? That's what political parties try to do. Understood this and were, in fact, they told the company, beginning to change not just their messaging, but even some of their policies to take more aggressive, radical positions, because that was the only way you were going to succeed on the platform. You know, like posting about health, you know, health policy or education policy, you know, wasn't going to get you anywhere. Whereas, you know, saying that your opponent, you know, is a criminal and a traitor was going to do quite well. And the company understood this. In fact, they could even sort of track the way that content was being amplified that met these criteria. There was and yet they didn't change it for years. Now, in the last couple of years, they've kind of backed off of this a little bit. They've sort of softened some of the edges. But, you know, there was no question internally among the people who were assigned to work on this stuff that, you know, it's not that Facebook was making the world inherently more polarized. I think they're trying to demonstrate causally that, mm-hmm. you know, the platform is responsible for some offline activity. Turns out to be really hard. But what the company could clearly demonstrate, and just by just simple A-B test type experimentation, was that ways that they changed the platform directly altered how, you know, sort of the tenor of political debate, whether things were more measured or more angry. And in the end, angry turned out to be better for engagement, and that tended to be where the company went for a number of years.
Jeff Horwitz is with us from the Wall Street Journal. His new book is called Broken Code: Inside Facebook and the Fight to Expose Its Harmful Secrets. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Have you seen the quality of your experience on Facebook or Instagram change over the years for the better, for the worse? Did the experience change to nothing? Did you give up on either or both platforms at some point? Do you think social media companies have a responsibility to make sure their content doesn't do harm in the real world? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. Right now, we're picking up the conversation with Jeff Horwitz, technology reporter at the Wall Street Journal. His new book is called Broken Code: Inside Facebook and the Fight to Expose Its Harmful Secrets. You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Are you one of the many Facebook or Instagram users who have reported problems with sleep, work, or relationships because of heavy use of the platform? Do you worry about how Facebook and Instagram's incentives are affecting you or your kids or our political system? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. Jeff, a key point of your book is, I think sometimes we might have looked at Facebook from the outside and seeing them kind of stumbling blindly into some of the problems they've had and then playing catch up. But a key part of the story you tell is there were people on the inside, a lot of them actually raising red flags at every step of the way, it seems like. Can you talk about who was putting up that fight within Facebook?
Yeah, sure. So I mean, I think, look, it took a while before people sort of really figured this out, right? There was a time period, I think, when everyone sort of accepted, everyone internally at least accepted the, statements by Mark Zuckerberg that, Facebook was just going to be a force entirely for good. At one point, Mark even said that Facebook and social media would end terrorism in the Middle East because people, once they connected with each other, could, wouldn't be able to hate each other anymore. Obviously, that has not worked out. Only really after 2016, and I think the ugliness of the 2016 election online, did people at the company really start like kind of coming to terms with the idea that perhaps not everything was always going to be for the best. I think there's sort of a period of a couple of years in there where, for the first time ever, really, instead of studying what makes people use the platform more and building more features that they think people might like, they actually start studying, what they're doing and how their own systems work. And, I think there'd been a lot of blind spots about that, and they did hire up a lot of safety staff, right? People who had, a lot of the engineers, data scientists, political scientists, user experience researchers, just kind of this like kind of army of social scientists and computer scientists that were there to sort of study how the platform actually worked in practice. And they were assigned to things like trying to avert genocide or trying to figure out whether in fact Instagram was potentially damaging to young women's body image, and under what circumstances that could occur. And so I think the fascinating thing is Facebook really did open up its wallet and spend on this stuff for a while, based in part on some of its leadership's, at least taking these concerns very seriously. And what they found was, I would say, generally not good. It was that the way the platform was optimizing itself was for the benefit of the platform, not so much for its users.
Bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Liz is with us in Milwaukee. Liz, hi.
Hi there.
What'd you?
My comment is, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, you go ahead. What did you want to bring up, Liz?
Well, I've been on Facebook for a long, long time, and I remember when news stories used to come up there a lot. The problem is there isn't anything anymore that is newsworthy. I mean, it's biased. It's so slanted that it has caused this great divide between opinions. And if we had unbiased news organizations actually broadcasting just the facts, I think it's something that could educate people, because there's a lot of people spending too much time on social media that have no clue what's going on in the world except what they hear on their one favorite news site.
Liz, thanks a lot for the call. That reminds me of a moment, Jeff, where Facebook tried to poll its listeners, I think, and say, hey, what is a credible news site? And they actually found people looked at a range of conservative, liberal, moderate sites, however you want to define them, and said, these are all okay. And they defined ones that were less credible. What talk about that process a little bit, and what, if anything, came out of it?
Yeah, I think, look, I think, judging who's credible and who isn't is always going to be a somewhat fraught and subjective process. And so one of the things that people inside Facebook, now Meta, tried to do was say, okay, well, let's just ask users, right? Let's not make a decision on it ourselves. Let's take that out of our own hands. And I think one of the interesting things was that, at least back when this work was getting done, this is circa 2018, people on both sides of the political spectrum in the US actually thought that both MSNBC and Fox were credible news sources, certainly compared to like some of the fly-by-night publishers that really only existed on Facebook. So we're talking here, some of them were run by kind of Macedonian high school students, some of them were just run by, domestic Americans who were just trying to sort of like get clicks any way they could. And, they actually did, this is one of those things that you can build pretty easily, which is that you could reward publications that were understood to have what they called broad trust. That work was pretty heavily watered down in the end. The company, I think, and in particular Mark Zuckerberg, was deeply uncomfortable with the idea that that the platform needed reining in the first place, right? In other words, the general philosophy was, well, if people are clicking on it, that must mean it's the better source of news. And as for what the caller was saying in terms of sort of the you know, her concern about kind of the decline of content, I think it's worth noting that the version of Facebook that we use now is not the same version of Facebook that people were on in 2010 or 2011. The whole thing has been sort of revamped via black box recommendation systems. So this is just kind of, you're looking for, as I was referencing earlier, just kind of very, very blunt correlations. And then you simply promote whatever makes, whatever variables are going to make the overall engagement number go up. And, you know, so used to be that you didn't see content from people that you didn't know, right? You only saw stuff from people you followed. Well, it turns out, though, that if you're trying to make that 10% annual growth in time spent goal that you alluded to earlier, that's not going to be enough, right? At some point, you know, you catch up with all your friends and now you're caught up. So what the company did was just sort of keep on pushing the frontier in terms of what it recommended. That was something that I think for a lot of the employees, they just really didn't put much thought into quality, right? It was almost a point of pride, which is that they were neutral because they didn't pay any attention to, you know, or they didn't try to, you know, try to make any judgments about quality whatsoever. The problem was, is that not making a judgment about quality is the same thing as making a judgment about quality, right? This is something that, you know, it's not like the incentives are completely different in the news business and the one, you know, what you and I do. You know, if we say crazy stuff, really aggressive stuff, that'll get more attention. But I think we kind of hold ourselves back. The interesting thing is machines don't do that.
Thanks for the call. We're talking to Jeff Horowitz about his new book, Broken Code, Inside Facebook and the Fight to Expose Its Harmful Secrets. Jeff, you mentioned at one point the company had hired up more safety people. I think that has changed over the years. And even at the most, there is a whole world of people speaking different languages and lots of challenges, including human trafficking organized on Facebook, violent attacks organized and sometimes filmed on Facebook. Is there enough safety staff to deal with those and the many other problems on the platform?
In the sense of like being able to take down all the bad stuff, no, and there never will be. I think, you know, the company, it really, safety did not come first at the company. I think when they expanded internationally, they regularly expanded into markets where they literally did not have a single person on staff who spoke even the main language of the country that they were going into, let alone, you know, in places like India, where there are scores of languages spoken by, you know, by millions of people each. They simply just didn't do it. You know, some of that I think is an issue of just funding, but there was also just kind of the issue that I think a lot of the people internally came to realize that just trying to like remove the bad stuff was a losing game. First of all, defining the bad stuff is hard, and second of all, the tools, you know, that basically the AI and algorithms that detect problem content are candidly much less effective than the ones that promote content to boost engagement. It's just a harder task for a lot of reasons. And so what a lot of the people who did safety work at the company kind of converged on was the idea that actually, rather than moderating the platform more, they had this kind of, the better move was going to be just to slow it down, to not recommend content when you didn't know what it was, to perhaps make it so that things didn't move quite so quickly. Maybe you didn't need to be able to invite 2,000 people per day into a group. I mean, I think there's a famous example internally. It was a single person invited 400,000 Americans into QAnon related groups in the course of 6 months, right? Now that's fanatical, obviously. I mean, just imagine clicking 400,000 times on that, right? But at the same time, the platform really was vulnerable to anyone who was willing to put in the effort to manipulate it.
And that's where we'll leave it. Thanks to our guest, Jeff Horowitz. His new book is called Broken Code, Inside Facebook and the Fight to Expose Its Harmful Secrets. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. You're listening to The Ideas Network.